This episode is sponsored by porkbun.com. Porkbun is a refreshingly different domain name registrar that's different from the other ones like GoDaddy or Namecheap. They've got low prices on hundreds of different domain extensions. They've got everything from .com domains to really cool ones like .pro, .dev, .xyz. Every domain name at Porkbun comes with tons of freebies too, like SSL certificate, Whois privacy, DNS, URL forwarding, and hosting trials. Because why pay for things that should be free, right? All these incredible features and tools are backed by incredible support, 365 days a year, and more five-star reviews on Trustpilot from real customers than anyone else. Look, you can get $1 off your next domain name from Porkbun and see why they're the best domain name registrar around by using our code. Just go to porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. That's Porkbun, porkbun.com/rocketshipfm24. You'll save $1 on your next domain.
As AI continues to revolutionize our world, there's a critical conversation we can't ignore: AI safety and security. And that's where HackerOne's AI red teaming comes into play, rigorously testing AI models to prevent them from being misled or exploited. HackerOne employs over 2 million ethical hackers, and 750 of them specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and testing. So HackerOne isn't just theorizing, they're actively safeguarding AI's future. Just recently, a team unearthed over 100 vulnerabilities in just 2 weeks. So whether you're at the helm of a startup or steering product innovation at a large company, it's time to prioritize AI security. Visit HackerOne.com/AI for more. Again, HackerOne.com/AI.
This episode is brought to you by Gigantic. At Gigantic, you can level up your product skills through live, small group, cohort-based trainings. We're incredibly excited to welcome you to our next cohort of our product strategy training, kicking off in January of 2024. This course will take you through the frameworks that product leaders use at companies like eBay, DoorDash, Groupon, Rent the Runway, in order to scale their teams. It's taught by Ben Foster, a friend of this podcast, who is the former chief product officer at Whoop. So come join us. Go to gigantic.is. That's gigantic.is. And save your seat for our January cohort. Your potential is gigantic, and we're here to help you reach it. Go to gigantic.is to reserve your seat today. So, Mike, today's episode, it's a wild ride. It's got a little bit of everything: cutting-edge technology, theft, lawsuits, a battle over the morality of ICE contracts, and...
That sounds like plenty already.
I was just getting started, but...
Oh, man.
So today we have the story of Kairos, the facial recognition software founded by Brian Brackeen, a Black founder who famously refused to sell or even contract with the government to the dismay of his board.
Those government contracts, they can be lucrative in the space.
Yeah, and what happened when their disagreement came to a head and the board, they actually moved to oust him.
Which isn't something you commonly see for white founders, if we're being honest.
Right, not at all. But this is the story of a founder who refused to compromise on his values.
So did he get ousted? Did they end up selling their software to the government?
All right, not so fast, right? We've got a lot of ground to cover today, so let's get started. Welcome to Rocketship.fm.
Rocketship FM is produced in partnership with Product Collective.
We are your hosts, Michael Sacca.
And I'm Mike Belsito.
So Kairos was founded in 2012 by Brian Bracken and Amanda McClure.
And 2012, that's early for facial recognition.
Yeah, but they didn't initially set out to build a facial recognition platform at all. They actually set out to build a time clock application for small businesses.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's not exactly the natural first step, but here's Brian, their founder and CEO, talking about that transition from a time clock application to facial recognition software.
You know how Elon Musk has this talent, this gift for taking kind of an early idea years ago about, you know, less carbon footprint in the world, right? And then just create this thing step by step, piece by piece over years to this, the kind of beautiful, elegant, you know, end. I'm not like that. Nothing like that. So I think my gift is really iteration. I started out the company doing payroll on like mobile devices, right? So you could clock in, clock out for your shift on your phone. And it was a time clock company, a mobile time clock company. And so people started cheating the system. Like they would, like, I would like call you like, hey man, I'm going to be late. Like put my number in. And then so, you know, right. And so we started using the front facing camera on the iPhone, which was new at the time. This is how like old, you know, things were. And then that changed everything. It made the product better, but people started saying, hey, like, I love your time clock, but can I use your facial recognition to do this, to do that, to do this for my business? Yeah. And like, that was like, the light goes off. Like, oh, like, let's do facial recognition for business. Like, let's make it easier for them to use. Like, that's a much bigger business. We could all get excited about that. Let's just run in that direction. And then the company just took off after that.
So Brian and his team have a strong signal that facial recognition is the pivot that they need, and they go full on into it.
It was actually around this time that I was running a brand asset management startup called Brandesty, and his design team was one of our first early customers, and that's how I actually first heard of Brian and Kairos.
Interesting. Okay. So when he says it took off, he really means it took off.
Yeah, not long into the journey, they were processing close to 1 billion faces a year for everything from like summer camps to large companies like Walmart and Disney.
Here's Brian again giving us an example of how they would work with, say, a summer camp.
What camps do oftentimes is they send pictures of all the campers every day. You've got to kind of like search through the pictures to find your kid, because honestly, you don't care about, you know, some other kids, you know, summer, right? You don't care what Timmy had for dinner, right? You want to see your kid, right? And so they use facial recognition so that they can show and bubble up just your kid's pictures for you when you log in to see how your kid's doing at camp.
It's very cool. And he goes on to explain the type of work that they would do for those large customers as well.
For people like for NBC and Fox, those folks, they may want to know, like, show me every single frame that Tiger Woods is in an image. And this thing's happening, and this one of the master or whatever. They need a picture for the background, for just a video clip of Tiger Woods being happy, right? So they can just search Tiger Woods happy, and it goes through all the photos, finds all the Tiger Woods ones, finds all the ones where he's got this emotion available, and then shows them those pictures. They can use whatever they want. So it's for solving those needle in the haystack problems. Find something in this larger group that I care about.
Now, this technology, this wasn't something just cobbled together quickly. This was developed over an 8-year period.
Right. This wasn't a weekend hack project. They put in the work.
I'd say over an 8-year period, the first, and this is true for AI, the first 4 are trash, right? Like, what happens is AI is like a kid. And so, like, a newborn can't communicate, doesn't know what you're talking about, you know, just basically cries, that kind of thing. I mean, you have to feed it, right? Now you have to feed it child knowledge so that it can like slowly get better and better and better. And hopefully that you and me at the end. It's the learning that matters. And almost think about like, almost like any of us, the more experience we can get earlier, the kind of the better we are on the trajectory, right? Same is true for AI. You've got to say, this is a face, this is a face, this is a face, this is a smile, this is a smile, this is a smile, this is emotion, that emotion. You just feed it like almost like cue cards, hundreds of thousands, or actually hundreds of millions of times, until it learns what those things are in new pictures or new faces that it hasn't seen in the past. This is what we call going from in the techie world, unsupervised, from supervised learning to unsupervised learning, where it can start to learn by itself without any cue cards. And so that for us, that happened about 4 to 4.5 years in. And then after that starts to happen, the accuracy goes way up. And then you get a product that's worth buying.
So it took years to train their algorithm, not just on how to match a face, but detect emotions and other features. And they're actually one of the early companies to productize all of this and make it available to the business community at scale.
When Kairos was founded, the market for facial recognition software was in its infancy and largely driven by government contracts.
I mean, when we first started the company, it was like, there's very, 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 very few people in the market, like at all. It wasn't a thing. Also, AI, though AI existed, I founded the company in 2012. So AI existed in 2012, but not in the way that we understand it today. So these problems were very, very difficult, and they were solved in actually different mathematical ways than they were later on. So I'd say the market was very limited, mostly government use, and very slow, very, you know, like all technology, very clunky and not very accurate. So it took, for me, but really more the team, a real vision to say that we could do this. Let's just go that direction.
Now, they also had a secret weapon in all of this.
And that secret weapon was?
Brian himself, right? There's a bias in all technology. And in most facial recognition system studies, they have found that they misidentify people of color more than white people.
The term we use in science sometimes is pale male. So the paler you are, the maler you are, the more of those initial cue cards you're giving the algorithm, right? And so it only learns that, and it has a hard time with every dimension off of pale male. So even a white woman, the average algorithm is 30% less effective on white women than it is on white men. And that's like still both on the one end of the spectrum. There's still a lot of humans on the other side, right? So we became experts at this problem. We trained our algorithm on all different kinds of colors, all different races, ages, gender, you name it. And so we ended up with a really strong differentiated product, so much so that I was on a panel at South By with the head of facial recognition for the FBI. And he said at the panel publicly to everyone, the Kairos facial recognition is far superior to what we use at the FBI, right? So leading to your next question, like that's when government started to come and ask to use it.
Now, I remember reading about this, I think. I mean, Asian and African-American people were up to like 100 times more likely to be misidentified than, say, white men, depending on the particular algorithm and the type of search. And Native Americans had the highest false positive rates of all ethnicities. I believe that was according to a study by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which is a federal laboratory.
Yeah. And that study was done in 2019. Now, most of these technology companies are being led by white men, trained by white men, and then tested by white men, but not Kairos. Brian made sure that his team trained their algorithm on a diverse set of data, making it the most accurate facial recognition system across both gender and race.
I think I can tell where this is starting to get going.
Yes, so we're just getting started here. After the break, we'll find out what the government wanted to do with Kairos' technology and what led to the now infamous board fight. All right, before the break, we were discussing the bias in most facial recognition software and how Kairos had trained their algorithm differently to more accurately detect across race and gender.
Now, most facial recognition companies were, and maybe still are, mostly funded by government contracts.
But Brian, early on, fearing the misuse of his technology, put a stake in the ground and said, "We're not working for or selling to any law enforcement agencies, including the government."
I would say, kind of owned the conversation on the facial recognition side around not working with the government. When we first said to the world that we weren't going to work with the government, I don't think that there were any facial recognition companies that had ever even said that as a thing. There was literally no, and there may still not be, there was literally no facial recognition company at the time that wasn't doing government work, because it's the only way that you could kind of sustain yourself. We were a lean team, small team. We'd raised some venture capital, so we didn't have to have all those dollars. And we took a longer view that just wasn't the right thing. Also, I am fairly sure that at the time, and possibly still now, was the only Black facial recognition CEO in the country. So probably North America, and South America, and Europe. There may have been a couple in Africa, I hope. It's a very short list.
So Brian was very clear that they weren't going to go down this route when they raised capital. He was upfront every time a new government contract would cross his desk. But at some point, his board saw the dollar signs and they wanted in.
And Brian fully understood both sides of the argument here. On one hand, their technology would lead to less false positive, which in law enforcement has a drastic and even deadly consequence when they get it wrong, especially for people of color.
On the other hand, though, I mean, his technology in the hands of, say, the Trump administration, that could be used in racist and abusive ways, at least from Brian's perspective.
On the bad side, we didn't have to imagine. These are the actual requests themselves were offensive. So one of the requests from a big government contractor was the Trump administration. This is at the end. So this Trump is already at this point. Wanted to do facial recognition on main streets. They wanted to set up cameras in the road and then look for undocumented immigrants as they drove by in their car. And then the second camera facing the other direction would take a picture of their license plate, and then they would go to that person's house and then remove them from the country, like in a mass surveillance kind of world. Hell no, absolutely not. Like, we had a request from Taser to, they were doing an R&D project about putting facial recognition on body cam. So again, the theoretical use case actually isn't too bad. It's like, so if the officer sees a bad guy, if they're known to be armed and dangerous, it could maybe a little vibration or some kind of like feedback. Right. And then they can protect themselves before they even know who the person is. On its face, I absolutely think that that's a very positive thing. Right. What happens is we've discussed the bias in facial recognition algorithms. And so if I'm going to be wrong about women 30% more than men, and I'm going to get a false positive, right, that someone who actually is innocent is guilty, and I'm going to get this Pavlovian vibration. That means I can go for my weapon and I can say, listen, I was told, and actually you can almost make an argument that that's actually fair to the officer, but they were told that this person was dangerous. And so they were on high alert. Right. And so it's a no for me. I want to do summer camp, facial recognition. I want to do retail stores. Fine. Let's stick to that. There's plenty of money in that.
This, while unsurprising, is honestly a disgusting use of this technology. I understand why he fought so hard to stay out of this side of AI and facial recognition.
Yeah, I mean, there's no redeeming side to this. I mean, someone, unfortunately, though, is going to take the contract and execute on it, but it's not going to be Brian.
But his board saw it differently.
So the government keeps knocking on the door. And I keep sending them away. And the investors, they don't want to put any more money in. They want, take their money, take the government money, take this, whatever. And they get, it got to be so just ridiculous, the kinds of requests that they would have. And I also think race plays a huge role in that too. And I'm not, and your viewers wouldn't know this from my life, but I'm generally kind of not one of these kind of, not rah-rah kind of guys, but, and not the race car, calling guys, but it's, we just see time and time again that the transformational Black founder is seen as lucky, and the white founder is seen as Mark Zuckerberg, has to be protected at all times, has to have a special class of stock, supermajority voting rights. We got to make sure that Mark is happy. He is the thing that makes this thing go, right? And you see what happens with Facebook, the way it's behaved. You see how it's happened at WeWork before they got rid of Adam Neumann. No one should really be kind of above. And yet with Black founders, they're replaced at such a high rate by these investors. That's exactly what happened in my case.
Okay. Now, it was much more than pressure that they were putting on him. As Brian puts it, they didn't have the vision he had. He saw a huge opportunity in having the most diversely trained algorithm. Companies like Amazon already had issues with this, and there was a growing market of enterprise use cases where he could be the leader in that market. Plus, he's one of the only Black founders in the space, so he actually saw an advantage in that acquisition story of having a Black man lead a facial recognition at a large company, say, Amazon, right? This would be a huge PR win for them.
But his board could only still see government contracts.
What do you do if you've got this kind of well-liked Black founder, right? You've got to try to drag him, right? You got to see, he's horrible. He did this, he did that. They said I took $30,000.
The board initiative was led by Stephen O'Hara, and they removed Brian as CEO as they moved into this lawsuit, and they put Melissa Dorval in the CEO position while the lawsuit went through court.
they claim that Brian stole $30,000 from the company by making purchases on his company credit card that were for personal use. The board claimed Brian misled shareholders and potential investors, misappropriated corporate funds, didn't report to the board of directors, and created this divisive atmosphere. Keros, the company, also followed that up with a lawsuit alleging theft and breach of fiduciary duties, among other things.
Was there any merit to this claim? That and more after a quick word from our sponsors.
So before the break, the Keros board had removed Brian from the company and filed a lawsuit against him, claiming that he misappropriated company funds and breached his fiduciary duties.
But it didn't end there. Brian countered with a lawsuit seeking to hold Keros and Dorval accountable for intentionally destroying his reputation and livelihood through fraudulent conduct, the publication of malicious falsehoods, and the commission of illegal corporate acts. He alleges Keros refused to pay him the compensation for which he was entitled.
Dorval, in a rather miscalculated move, released a public statement. We've come to expect this behavior on his behalf, and we stand firmly with our original complaint, and the courts will rule in our favor once they're presented with the evidence for the case. Our fiduciary duty is to our stakeholders, and we remain dedicated to doing right by them.
But you know what? They didn't, right? The court eventually ruled in favor of Brian, citing no wrongdoing, and forced Dorval, the board, and Keros to pay him compensation for dragging his name through the mud.
And look, time and time again, this is often the playbook for discrediting black men in America. Our media already purports this narrative of black men as criminals. Melissa Dorval, Stephen O'Hara, Keros, they tried to use this playbook against Brian in this greedy attempt to sort of cash in on what he built and go after government contracts, which he said from the beginning they were never going to go after.
Yeah, but you know what? Brian didn't even need the $30,000.
I'm a fourth-generation millionaire in my family. Not very often you hear that amongst African-Americans. I haven't needed $30,000 in my life. I needed it to my father. I needed it to my grandfather. I needed it to my great-grandfather, who was a doctor in Segregated Texas. He's the only guy in town with a car, you know, white or black. So, like, this idea, but, you know, but it's not about the reality. It's about what do you do when you're trying to get rid of a black guy? You say he's a thief or whatever. It's disgusting. So that's they went that route. I sued them. One, and this is the funny thing, they ended up owing me money. This goes to show how ridiculous.
Okay, I didn't see that coming. I guess maybe we all, including me, have a little bias.
Yeah, I didn't either in the interview. But, you know, it cracked me up, right? And so after the lawsuit, Brian didn't go back to Keros. But Melissa Dorval, Stephen O'Hara, and everyone else involved in pushing him out and kind of going forward with the smear campaign immediately resigned, and the company is now under new leadership.
And through all this, talk about destroying company value. Before this nonsense, Keros was valued at $120 million, but right after the lawsuit, it was selling shares at a $1.5 million valuation.
That's the price of racism.
So now Brian has gone on to found Lightship Capital.
Yeah, so the ethos behind Lightship Capital is really, at its kind of core, to be the investor in everything, right? We're focused on a couple really unfair situations in society. For those that are in the Midwest and South, these are the best places in the country to start a business. And yet all the venture capital goes to the coasts. And so when you look at, there's been studies done that we share with our investors, for every dollar you put on the map, for every dollar you put in the Midwest, you can get a $5.17 return on your money when you exit in the Midwest. You get a $3.47 return in San Francisco and in that part of the country, because it costs so much more money to build a business there. There's so much more venture capital, and you're exiting for the same amount. The deal is, no matter where you are in the country, you could be in Idaho, you could be in New York City. If you're doing $100 million revenue, you're gonna get bought for the same amount. Like, it's math. Like, we're gonna pay you three times revenue. Here's your $300 million. It doesn't matter where you are, right? Like, so if that's the truth, why would you build a company in the cheapest place in the country, because you're gonna get the same amount of money at the end? Right, so that's first piece of a thesis is the Midwest, primarily, and also the South, are places that we look to invest. The second piece of the thesis is there are people that are underrepresented in that group, right? And so take women, for instance, right? They're half the population, right? But receive like 3% of all venture capital dollars. Yeah, less than. It just like that gap, and it's literally a financial term, that market failure means that there are really great opportunities in those women that are just not going invested. And so we often tell our investors that the actual reality is there are two ponds. On one on each side of the street, there are 100 guys in San Francisco and New York trying to catch 5 fish in the pond on the one side of the street. I'm over here in a pond full of fish. They're jumping out of the, like, literally by myself, like, where am I? No one to talk to. I'm just catching fish all day.
And then he told me this incredible founder story, and his ethos around the opportunity really started to click.
A company called Prove. It's a progesterone ovulation test. Progesterone is an important hormone for both getting pregnant for women and staying pregnant. And Dr. Amy Beckley, who was a scientist at the University of Michigan, had 7 miscarriages. And you can imagine how impactful that is for someone. Most of anyone I know, actually. And so she was like, that's it. Like, I'm going to solve my own problem. Like, I can't go through this. And so she goes into her basement, literally her basement, and creates a shelf-stable, FDA-cleared progesterone test in her basement. Sells a bunch of kits, tens of thousands of dollars of kits on Kickstarter, right? Is successful. Takes all this kind of success and goes to the JP Morgan Biotech Showcase in San Francisco to tell all the investors in the room, this is what I've done. Like, let's see if I can get investment to go to the next stage. She gives a presentation, she gets off stage. Not a single person goes to talk to her after that crazy story, except for my wife, Candace, who's my co-general partner in our fund. Who we work with Procter & Gamble a lot here in Cincinnati. And she says, girl, like, I've got something for you. Like, Procter & Gamble is doing some work in this area. We worked so closely with them. We knew what the R&D stream was, that they had been working on progesterone tests and had not a lot of success in their work, right? $90 billion company. And so, yeah, we bring her in. We're able to make her a Procter & Gamble fellow. She gets help with R&D and supply chain and a variety of things. The company's growing like crazy. It's doing very well. To this day, right now, to this day, we are still the only institutional investor in that company. It's insane, but it's great for us. It's great. We're going to make a ton of money. Like, she's going to sell it to someone and we're going to make a bajillion bucks. But it's crazy that those guys that day in San Francisco didn't see it. But that's literally what a market failure is. Like, that's a failure. And then those of us can make money on that, but also help the founder, right?
And she went on to have 2 kids thanks to her innovation.
And then he had one more story about another founder that he's invested in that honestly never would have made it into, you know, the VCs in Silicon Valley radar.
A company called Fresh Fry. Jeremiah Chapman is a chemist in Louisville, Kentucky, right? His grandmother, when he was a kid, be like a lot of ours, would kind of fry fish or fry things, and they kind of like take the oil and they put it up. Did your grandma used to do that when you were a kid or whatever? Like, yeah. And now we're like, why would you do that? I don't know. Like, I've never done that in my entire life. But he got obsessed with that as a kid. Like, why is she doing it? What's the deal? She actually used a potato to like filter it. And so he goes and becomes a chemist and decides to create like a Tide pod for cooking oil that you put the pot in at the end of the night. It sucks all the impurities, all the dirt, all the smoky smell out of the oil. And then the next day you just kind of throw the Tide pod out. Fully organic, and it's for commercial cooking oil, right? So if you're like at a restaurant, you're frying French fries all night, it extends the life of the oil for 2 or 3 days, which is like maybe almost like 30 or 38%, that kind of thing. It saves people a ton of money. So this is a like we're just talking about, when you're a Black chemist from Louisville, Kentucky, there is no one in your network that you would have to like be a venture capitalist in San Francisco. Like there's no overlap between them. Those two worlds at all, right? And then think about VC funds in San Francisco. They insist on warm intros, right? They will not talk to you unless you have a warm intro. This keeps out women. This keeps out minorities. It keeps out people from Kentucky, right? But again, that's fine. We'll make all the money. So we invested in that company, one of the first two institutional investors. This company, because they have no sense that any help was ever going to come, they just focus on doing well. 2.5 years old, they're already in 4,000 restaurants around the country, right? They're already doing multiple millions of dollars in revenue, 2.5 years old. That would never be true of a San Francisco firm, ever, right? And so, this is the story, this is the work, that's kind of the kind of founders that we're backing.
It's very, very inspiring. And I love hearing stories like this. And I got to tell you, Michael, I enjoyed this episode. Do you think we went maybe too far, though?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think we still have a long way to go. In fact, next week, we're going to feature a founder who went to prison at 15 for 8 years. And despite 20 years of success as an entrepreneur, he's now in his 40s. He's still grappling with the consequences of that. That and more next week on Rocketship FM. Thanks so much for listening to Rocketship.fm. Rocketship FM now has a premium ad-free feed. All you have to do is go to glow.fm/Rocketship and subscribe. It helps support the show and it gives you an ad-free experience. You actually get an exclusive feed that you can listen to on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Yeah, and Rocketship FM is produced in partnership with Product Collective, which is a community for software product people. Product Collective is also the home of Industry, the Product Conference, Industry Virtual Workshops, and one of the largest Slack groups for product people anywhere.
And we're also on the Podglomerate Network, so a huge thanks to Podglomerate. You can listen to all the Podglomerate shows at thepodglomerate.com. We'll see you here next week on Rocketship.fm.